All right, I'd like to call this August 7th meeting of the Historic Preservation Commission to order. And we'll start with introductions, starting over here on my left, and we'll go around to the right.
Mark Person, City of Vancouver.
Jackie Camp, Clark County.
Sharon Lou Montobin, Clark County.
Alex Gall.
Michelle Kapitonovich.
Don Trost.
Julie Bond.
And we'll note that Sean Denniston is absent currently, and Rock Manley is supposed to show up a little later. So first order of business will be approval of the July 2nd meeting minutes. If anyone hasn't had a chance to review them, I'll give you a couple minutes to look them over, and then we'll make a motion.
We've got a little typo on page 3 at the top.
What is the typo?
It's at the top of page 3. It's place a new. It's E-N-T-E-R-Y, and I think you mean entry.
On the top of page 3?
First
page
word.
Page oh, entry is spelled wrong.
First word.
Okay.
Move approval as amended by Michelle.
Second.
I second.
All in favor of approving last month's meeting minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passed. Let's see. I'd like to make a motion. We have a person, a guest here today, and I'd like to make an effort to get him out of here in a timely manner. He came on my invitation as part of our intangible cultural heritage effort, which is, as you'll see, lower down on the agenda, and I'd like to move it to the top of the agenda. And so I will entertain, I can make the motion. I'd like to make the motion that we move the intangible cultural heritage update to the top of the agenda, and then we'll go into the public hearing for the code update.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. So the Intangible Cultural Heritage Subcommittee had our first meeting on July 31st, and I will just update the rest of the commission on where we ended with things and what's yet to come. Sharon has prepared a scope of work for the committee, and I'll refer to it as the ICH committee, just for brevity. And we, the subcommittee, are to get edits back to Sharon by August 21st. For that, the subcommittee is also going to review the NACP proposal, presentation proposal, dealing with the ICH, and we will get those edits to Sharon by August 9th, which is 2 days from now. Let's see. Sharon has also put together a PowerPoint presentation. We had talked about preparing some kind of a PowerPoint presentation to take around to different communities to introduce the topic and explain what it is and benefits and everything. So we're going to work through that, and we're going to edit that over the course of the next couple of meetings. I am charged with preparing a list of contacts, and I have started that with tribal contacts, and am going to start moving on to non-tribal contacts. And Julie has also reached out to a couple of
prune growers.
Prune growers,
prune
yes.
Dryers, I guess you could say.
Yes, the last of the prune dryers. So anyway, we'll compile those contact lists and then compile them into one. Andy also has a contact at the Cowlitz tribe that he was going to reach out to. And our next ICH subcommittee meeting is September 11th, and so we're going to strive to have monthly meetings on this and keep the ball rolling. And with that, I did reach out to Nathan Reynolds, who's here today, and he's the Interim Cultural Resource Director?
Sure.
Of the Cowlitz Tribe. And he and I had a very good conversation over the phone, and after it, I said, I wish the rest of the commission could hear this just to get an idea. And he said, yeah, I'd be happy to come. So I'd like to welcome Nathan Reynolds.
Thank you for having me here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. I don't know exactly what sort of conversations you've had in the past, but I could tell you a little bit about myself, if that would be a place to start. I've only been in this county 48 years, so that's as far back as I go. I am essentially an environmental historian by training, but I have worked as an employee for the Cowlitz Tribe for 14 years, starting in their natural resources department, principally focusing on habitat restoration for the species that are traditionally culturally important to the Cowlitz people. Huckleberry restoration projects, I was able to shepherd the Endangered Species Act listing of Ulacon through that listing process. We do a lot of fisheries research. We do a lot of oak woodlands management. Essentially all of those food or material culture resources, again, that are high value to the Cowlitz people. A year and a half ago, I was asked to lead the cultural resources department for the Cowlitz tribe, and so I have been trying to do that to the best of my ability. And so in doing that, have been able to focus a lot more on the intangible cultural properties of the landscape, items of spirituality, places of spirituality, places of cultural use, places of resource gathering. I was able to co-author the nomination for Mount St. Helens to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places as a traditional cultural property for the Cowlitz people. It was only the 23rd property, traditional cultural property nationwide on a list of over 80,000 places. So again, Alex and I had what I thought was a great conversation, and I'm happy to have that conversation in a group form if that's something that you'd like to entertain or answer any specific questions you may have.
Well, I think, you know, as we start on this process, we want to gauge interest of the communities that we have identified or have yet to identify in the county that would be receptive to the listing of something on an intangible cultural heritage register. You know, there are so many layers to this issue, and we discussed a lot of them in our subcommittee meeting about whether we're looking at only current practices or would we open it up to historic practices that perhaps are only practiced by one or two individuals, or perhaps none at all. Is this something that would include cultural landscapes? There are a lot of questions, and I think talking to you, maybe you can just expand on what we were talking about in terms of what the Cowlitz might consider a worthwhile intangible cultural heritage property that they might be listed. We had spoken about prairies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, prairies are a landscape feature, so one could argue they're tangible, but along with the prairies comes a whole host of intangible practices, cultural traditions, you know, different. I mean, take it from here.
So, yes, the Clark County is a fascinating landscape, and we think of Clark County from the education that we received as a wilderness, but clearly When colonial forces arrived in this area, there was a thriving community of indigenous people who lived here in many small villages up and down the Columbia River, essentially a village every mile with up to 1,000 people in it. So even just the Washington side of the Columbia River probably had a population of 20,000 people. And they gathered from the Columbia River fish and other resources, but those floodplain areas, and in particular what Alex is steering me towards, in the interior of Clark County had an assembly of prairie habitats that were very, very important for indigenous communities. They were a site of particular food resources like camas roots, also associated oak savannas that had acorn, acorns were an important carbohydrate resource. And these habitats, strictly from an environmental perspective, were broadly spread across the landscape 12,000 years ago and diminished in abundance to about 6,000 years ago when the climate changed a little bit. And as a result of that climate change, we started growing trees, conifer trees, in the Pacific Northwest in high abundance. And these prairies that were found and are still remnant in the middle of Clark County were actually maintained and persisted as a result of thousands of years of Indian burning. So Indian management of the landscape to keep trees out, to keep these root foods present on the landscape for generations and generations and generations. Climate change, climatologically, they would have just winked out of existence. And so they're only here and persisting today as this evidence of pre-contact landscape management. And that's woven into a whole bunch of different things in Clark County's history. The roads that you know as Mill Plain and Fourth Plain were Hudson's Bay Company roads from the fort to the mill that they established. But the mill was established below Mill Plain, and it was a plain because it was an open grassy area. Fourth Plain Road that we know of today winds its way across the landscape, but it passed through First Plain and Second Plain and Third Plain before it got to Fourth Plain. Fourth Plain was the biggest, where the Hudson's Bay Company would run their cattle. These prairies, again, were very important. They were rapidly adopted for and settled and staked and claimed by people who settled into this area, because they didn't have to do all the stump removal. And even the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company, who was describing the situation of Fort Vancouver, described Fort Plain. He said, the roots grow so promiscuously here that the hogs can be fed on them with no work whatsoever. And what he failed to realize, again, was that those roots were only so abundant because of thousands of years of near agriculture on the part of the indigenous people who lived in this landscape. So in the modern era, when you're looking for intangible cultural properties or aspects of life, a camas prairie is both pre-contact important to indigenous communities, but it's very important to the patterns of settlement that we have in the county. It's important to our road infrastructure. It's important to our lifeways now. The area that is northwest of Lacamas Lake is set aside by the DNR as a natural areas preserve, a natural resources conservation area, and so even in the modern era now, the DNR has identified that that landscape is an important landscape worthy of conservation. So these places still affect our planning and our development structures and schedules now. So that's a fantastic example that this particular species of plant, the suite of species found in these landscapes, has heritage that affects both indigenous communities and all of the people who have come to live in this landscape in the intervening time. There's other examples that I could share, but that's certainly one that you could point to as a resource that is tied to landscape, but it's actually tied to that species more than anything else.
And that was another one of the questions that came up in our subcommittee meeting was intangible cultural heritage that is locationally unique to Clark County, or would it include things that are also prevalent outside of Clark County? And, you know, the prairies seem to be certainly we're not the only county with maintained prairies, but it is very much kind of a unique aspect of Clark County that so much of our development was driven by the presence of these prairies on the landscape to begin with. So, anybody have any questions for Nathan or?
I guess I struggle with understanding what makes it intangible. It sounds very tangible to me. And we ought to be thinking about how we might go about preserving the land itself for future generations. I know the prairies in Illinois, for example, that's a very important part of Illinois also. So what makes it intangible?
Well, I think it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I think it would be the suite of cultural traditions that are associated with the prairie maintenance, resource gathering in the prairies. Nathan opened it up to the historic, I mean, made that tie of continuity from pre-contact era through early history to the present, so there is that continuity. But I think the intangible part, and this is one of the questions we've been wrestling with, do cultural landscapes count as intangible heritage? I think you could argue both sides. I mean, I think there's also been a lot of literature on cultural landscapes as a standalone resource, if you will. But I sent something to Sharon the other day, is a National Park Service write-up on cultural landscapes, and there's some daylight in there for intangible cultural heritage, because it's typically the landscape as it's been affected by humans, but there is also, you know, for a lot of indigenous cultures, there's no difference between a natural resource and a cultural resource, right? Salmon is a natural resource to us, but it's a cultural resource to indigenous cultures. And so, where was I going with that? The landscape, but the way the National Park Service defines it, that there is some a hook there where we could hang the intangible cultural heritage hat on it. But again, that's something that we're kind of still figuring out the parameters of what constitutes intangible cultural heritage.
Let me draw a two-piece comparison. The Camas prairies are valuable for, again, cultural resources, but they're also just strictly environmentally valuable because they are rare species, rare habitat areas, and so they're also identified by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife as habitats of concern. And so they're in your zoning, they're in your management, they're in your development codes already. From the tribe's perspective, the persistence of Camas is very important. The intangible cultural heritage there is related to the ability to harvest Camas at that site, to cook it in a traditional way, to do the ceremonial work that needs to be done along with that processing of harvest, and then to have that available as a food resource. And so it's the practices that can occur in that landscape that are the intangible part. So the practices can't occur without the landscape. And so in the comparison here, I grew up in the Camas area, and I used to drive to the top of Prune Hill, and there was one field that I knew of that about 15 or 20 years ago that underneath the sprawling blackberry vines was the last prune orchard on top of Prune Hill. And it's now been developed, and it's now no longer there. And I'm not aware of any prune orchards to be had, plum orchards to be had on Prune Hill anywhere. And so in that instance, if you're talking about Prune Hill as a place, you have a place, you have all this knowledge of heritage that happened at the site, but you no longer even have an orchard on the ground anywhere you can point to. So in that case, you've got the opposite. You've got heritage, but the landscape has become intangible. Whereas on the first example, you have the landscape and the practices are intangible. Does that make sense between the two? Okay.
I guess what I'm saying is it seems to me that one of the concerns would be just not letting what happened on Prune Hill happen, so that it becomes both a concern about the tangible, the aerial impact, mm-hmm. as well as the intangible resources.
And that's another one of those questions is, what would be the benefits of a listing on such a register? Would it be in the case of, say, historically practiced, perhaps no longer practiced, like prune drying? Would it be for recording it and possible revival or maintaining the practice or something along those lines? I doubt prune orchards will come back to Prune Hill, but recording, I don't know, again, we're still figuring out definitions and, what even constitutes and what would be included. But all of this is, I think, good food for thought and for us to take to our next committee meeting and subcommittee meeting and chew on for a little bit.
I was just going to say, it really sounds, what I'm hearing is, it really sounds like it's preservation, like with a capital P, in terms of, what were those cultural aspects that are lost. And it's almost similar to, we're working on the demolition, what to do about demolition and physical entities disappearing, where, they just become whatever memory we've recorded of them. And that's, I'm kind of seeing a connection between these two.
But I think with this, though, it's more of a living thing. I mean, the emphasis, I think, is to raise awareness and give voice to communities that may not typically have much voice in Clark County, but to raise awareness and not necessarily preservation being the number one, although maybe, but it's definitely, we're looking for things that are hopefully still being practiced. And in the case of things like traditional resource gathering methods, in some cases maybe on the rise as tribes find new footing in, the Cowlitz are experiencing a bit of a cultural resurgence, with federal recognition and, the land that they've gotten in Clark County and stuff. So, for me, one of the things that I keep running into lately is peeled cedars. I'm out on a project area and I'm finding peeled cedars and they're not that old. They're not more than 50 years old. And so it's telling me that this traditional practice is still happening. And, it was maybe those ones that I showed you up in the Cowleman, maybe 25, 30 years old. But it tells me there's, this practice that, of course, cedar trees don't live forever, so we don't know how far back this practice went, but we're seeing them on the landscape still. And, what all goes into cedar gathering, processing, making of baskets, hats, clothing, you name it.
Let me offer another example. I mentioned the Endangered Species Act listing of Columbia River smelt or eulachon. In that case, the Cowlitz tribe was motivated to pursue the Endangered Species Act listing and to petition for it to be listed because the population of the fish had diminished. So, raise your hand if you ever dipped for smelt in the Columbia River. Anybody? All right, good. All right. So, when I started interviewing tribal elders about that species, they said, if the fish goes extinct, then my grandfather's fishing spot means nothing anymore. the way to harvest hoops of vine maple to make the hoops on the nets doesn't mean anything anymore. The way to weave nettle fibers into the net itself doesn't mean anything anymore. So if the fish goes extinct, all of these items of heritage, of material culture that are reflected in place, harvesting places, reflected in the making of the nets, they're reflected in the processing of the fish, how you smoke dry the fish, all of that intangible cultural heritage, in this case, is entwined with a species. It's less site dependent, it's not landscape dependent, it's tied to the river, yes, but they came broadly across many rivers. And so that's an example of intangible cultural heritage that is tied to species rather than place. So that's another way to look at what you could list. And I don't know what...
And we've looked at a lot at UNESCO, and the one that really pops to the surface because it's been recent is the Indonesian listing of batik. And there you have a tangible art form. I mean, it's tangible. It results in tangible... But the whole process and whatever beliefs and practices and traditions that go along with it that make up the art form of batik, those are what has been listed to the UNESCO. So, you know, it's interesting to be drawing these parallels and try to find where we can hang our hat and, you know, how this is going to play out. So I want to thank you for taking the time and coming here today.
Absolutely.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is the tribe interested in this? I mean, we're interested in having an intangible cultural heritage register. Would the tribe be interested to engage and have things listed, and would they see a benefit in that?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have interacted with Calhous County Historic Preservation Commission a few times. I'm happy to come and interact here as well. So all I need is the invitation and the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. I appreciate it.
And just as far as we know, I mean, we're basing this on the UNESCO model. Like, we haven't found any other American city or looking at this, so we want to go out in front and be a thought leader and look at how can we be more inclusive and look at this whole world of intangible cultural heritage.
And we may come to the conclusion that the Historic Preservation Commission isn't the right place for it, or we may come to the conclusion that, you know, no communities are interested in having things listed, and it may go nowhere. So, you know, we're keeping an open mind that, you know, don't want to shoehorn something in that isn't a good fit.
Yeah, I'm eager to hear, you know, what the committee is coming up with as far as definition of, you know, what we think intangible heritage is and what our goals are. I still see preservation of those techniques that you described with the smelt dipping that would disappear. And it's all preservation.
Yeah.
It's all preservation. And that's what we're about. So I think it's a perfectly
good fit.
Goal for us.
Good. All right. So with that, that concludes our. We had Rock just update you. We had made a motion to move up the into. Okay, you were filled in. All right, great. So we will move on to the public hearing portion of tonight's meeting, to the proposal to amend the Clark County Unified Development Code pertaining to historic preservation. Jackie Camp.
Hi. Hi. My name is Jackie Camp with Clark County, and this is a public hearing with the case number CPZ 2019-00028, amendments to Clark County's Unified Development Code Historic Preservation. Yes.
I should probably ask if any members have had any ex parte communications or conflicts of interest regarding this matter before we open up the public hearing.
No.
All right.
Okay. So last month we did a work session on the amendments that were proposed. So I'll kind of briefly go over what we talked about, since we kind of had a more in-depth conversation last month. Clark County has intergovernmental agreements with the 7 cities and town in Clark County for the historic preservation program. Those agreements were last updated in 97, and last year the county made, with the Historic Preservation Commission's work, some substantial amendments to our Historic Preservation Code, which then is reflected in intergovernmental agreements. So we will need to update those intergovernmental agreements with that new code reference. And during those discussions of the intergovernmental agreement, the City of Vancouver expressed an interest in discussing a change in the appointment process for our Historic Commission members to more align with how other city-county joint commissions are appointed, which would be that the city would appoint 2 members and then the county would appoint the existing members. So the change for the code is reflected in that intent. That's the one major part of it, which is in one section that we'll go through. The other part has to do with the appeals process for Historic Preservation Commission decisions. Currently, the Clark County appeals process for decisions go to Superior Court. With the intergovernmental agreements, it's up to each city jurisdiction to determine their appeals process. So our code will be able to explain that depending on whether or not the city has something in their code that dictates their appeal process, and if not, that it defaults to the same process that a property in the unincorporated Clark County would use, which is Superior Court. So those are kind of the two major changes, which are reflected in the staff report here. And to kind of reiterate, there was, our current appointment process has been pretty lengthy with the multiple review processes. So we think with this change as well, we'll streamline that process and take away some of the review steps that applicants have to go through for the appointment process. So this slide shows all the steps that we currently have to get someone appointed. So HPC committee, an interview, they recommend to city and county councils, then the city council has it, they could do interviews, then they have it at a hearing, and then they recommend to county council, who could then also interview and have their hearing. So many multiple steps. So our proposed, if the changes go through, it'll be, kind of go its different routes. So for city appointments, the Historic Commission would do their review, recommend to city council who would appoint. For county positions or county seats, the Historic Commission would review and interview and recommend to county council. So shorter process. So to kind of get in the details, briefly, and I did receive a suggested edit from Don, so I've made that. He caught a typo on page 2 of our staff report under findings, kind of the end of the sentence, second to last sentence about the City of Vancouver to appoint 2 of the 5 Historic Preservation Commission members. We are now changing the code to reflect that it will be 7 commission members. So I'm going to make that change moving forward. The changes include under the section D number 1, which is creation and size. So we're deleting a minimum of 5, and it will now be 7 members, with 5 being appointed by the county council and 2 by the Vancouver City Council. Pretty much that is, the rest of it has to do with the ability to look outside of the jurisdiction if that's where the professional expertise that has applied for the position, and we open that up for the City of Vancouver to also do that if they so choose. The next, we got rid of some under the terms section. That was kind of old language when the commission was first initiated, so our legal counsel felt it was not necessary to have the staggered, how we were going to stagger terms, because they're already established. Under this changes to, you know, members appointed by the council versus members appointed by City of Vancouver. And then the last section of appeals, which is towards the end of your packet on page 14, discussing or describing how the appeals process would work for properties that are not in unincorporated Clark County. So it would be the city, either something in their code that tells the appeals process, or it defaults to how the county has it here in this code. So those are the major changes, or those are the changes. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions for staff by the commission?
I just one question.
Sure.
And that was on item 3, terms, paragraph B. Just the county is empowered under that paragraph, but the city isn't mentioned. Is that, I know the county has the code, and maybe that's what leads to that.
Right. So when the city makes their changes to their code, they would include language for that. This is for the county seats only, yep.
Any other questions? So, presentation by the applicant.
That's pretty much us.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And questions of the applicant. I'm running through my public hearings bullet points here. Public comment. We have two members of the public. Yes, Holly.
Good evening. I am commenting tonight as a member of the public. Do I need to state my address?
Perhaps your name.
Name as well.
Okay. My name is Holly Chamberlain, and as a founding member of the Clark County Preservation Commission, I just want to endorse these changes. It's wonderful to see that the commission has endured all these years and that the community continues to find value in its activities and fund it. These are changes that reflect current circumstances and are necessary and logical updates, and I'm glad to see they're being proposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, oh, Nathan.
Hello again. The Calais Tribe supports these changes, but would note also that when the Calais Tribe has an established Tribal Historic Preservation Office, would appreciate the opportunity for an interlocal agreement and participation in the committee going forward.
Of course, wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the public hearing is now closed. And commission, it's time for commission deliberation, in which we must make findings to either agree with the staff's findings or make specific comments regarding any findings.
So first, thank you for considering my recommendations or comments from last time as well on how we ought to state relative county versus city. These look very logical to me, and I certainly support the findings, and thank you for the thorough staff report. Thank you for the comments from the public as well.
I think the good thing about it is that it streamlines the process for the applicants, you know, rather than having to do multiple interviews. So I think it's some good logical things being done here.
Thank you.
I support the staff recommendations and hand on the back for you guys. Good work.
Thank you.
I support it as well. I think it's open.
Well, it sounds like it's time to make a motion. I'll entertain a motion.
I move that we approve the amendments to the Clark County Unified Development Code regarding historic preservation.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved.
Thank you. And just to, so you know the next steps, just FYI, so we go to Planning Commission next month for their work session, and then hearing, and then on to County Council in October. So, and it'll be done.
Great.
Thank you.
Hold on.
Yeah.
concerned, when do you think we would see the city's version come through?
I think Jan said that they will have to do this, at least this tweak, to update when we do the intergovernmental agreement. So we should, you know, maybe she can, when she comes back next month, we can talk to her more about maybe plans on that. Yeah. Is that fair, Mark?
That sounds good to me. Yeah, Jan's kind of the more long, you know, long range policy stuff, and I have my kind of nose to the ground on the development.
Okay, moving on to new business. The first order of new business is to finalize the letter to new owners of historic properties. I suggest that perhaps in the interest of time that if folks have made edits or suggestions for that letter that we just pass them on to Sharon and she can incorporate them, unless people in the commission want to have a specific discussion regarding the letter at this point?
I just have a question.
Yeah.
You deleted one of the bullets on special valuation tax incentive program.
It's because Jan Bader had mentioned don't use jargon, say tax incentive.
So the second bullet covers it in the intent. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Anyone else?
I had comments, but I already sent them to Sharon.
Okay. And we'll have a chance to look at this again, I assume.
Maybe just the chair at this point, because have you seen it?
Okay.
Let's just have the chair kind of finalize it. That's okay?
It's fine with me.
Okay, moving on to the NAPC Forum 2020 call for proposals for sessions. We received three proposals, and one for demolition review, one for the intangible cultural heritage, and one for
enforcement, I guess you might call it.
I was trying to figure out. Sean Dennison has joined us, and it was his proposal, and I can't quite remember the short title of it. So we all have them. We need to have edits back to you by August 9th. Is that correct?
Possible. Unless there's some there might be some discussion
Friday
today.
Yeah.
Because we want to have it in what format and who's speaking, and you know, maybe not all three of you. So there's a little bit of discussion. Do you want to go one by one?
Sure. Let's start with the demolition.
Okay, and you have them in your laptop, in your iPad?
Yep.
These are
We got them.
Yeah.
Oh, didn't even need to bring this.
1, 3, 5. Is everybody on the website?
I have it on my laptop.
Okay.
So the proposal for the demolition review subcommittee has myself, Sean, and Don as potential presenters.
So do you want to do this as, kind of decide, is this a panel, a presentation, a roundtable? Is it just the county? Or do you want to invite the other cities that were part of that demo study? Those are kind of some.
Oh, yeah, that would. Well, is it only up to us? I mean, if we could.
Your proposal.
We could have a proposal.
DAP could come back to you and ask you to do something different. Not DAP. The NAPC.
Yeah.
It's what you want to propose at this point.
I think we should see if we could fill out a full panel.
I mean, it seems like a topic that everybody is probably should be wrestling with if they're not. and I think bringing in other cities sounds like a good.
So you want to say panel?
Panel.
Okay.
I think panel's a way to go.
Okay. So let me make that change. And then, so we still have a couple weeks before this is submitted. Do you or you want staff to reach out to have the contact list of the cities? Are you thinking it would be like two or three of the cities talking about their different approaches?
Yeah, I mean, I think Walla Walla, Bellingham, and Spokane might be good. Port Townsend seems like a bit of an anomaly because they have such a well-preserved downtown that...
But just to play devil's advocate, though, wouldn't it be nice to hear from them? So since they are successful, it would be good for them to perhaps share some of the reasons why they've been able to do what they've been able to do.
Yeah.
That could be a really good structure where we present and this is how we struggled with
Here's
it.
Here's our problem.
And then, you know, them, you know, if they do have a good solution, here's a good solution, or, and here's maybe another solution.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't particularly remember their...
I don't remember either.
I remember Walla Walla's and Bellingham's a lot better.
Do you want staff to reach out to those four and see if they'd be interested? And then whoever shakes out, we'll put them in?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do the three of you want to be on that panel, or one of you, or...
I think it looks too heavy if there's three of us and three cities. I don't think that makes a lot of sense to me, personally.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I'm willing to do it, but I defer to people who've been on the commission longer.
If that were our only submission, maybe?
Yeah. You
got three, and you don't know which one is going to be.
Right, and the deadline is September 9th for...
Good. Alex or Sean or Don, and sort it out later.
Yeah.
One of you, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is just abstract submission or proposals.
And we'll figure out once they tell us which ones are acceptable.
And they may say, we don't have a panel for you, but you can do a presentation.
How long are these typically?
9 minutes total. With some Q&A. So it could be like...
With the Q&A?
Yeah.
So you're asking people to speak maybe 5 to 7 minutes maximum. To then have time for an open...
Yeah, I mean, I've already prepared a presentation that I gave in May to another conference on this topic. So if we did go with just a presentation, I mean, I've got one fairly ready to go, except for what occurs between now and then.
How long is it, roughly?
About 20 minutes.
So if you did
and I got a fair amount of Q&A afterwards.
Yeah.
So,
if you did that and then had like two or three cities participate also, you'd still have 20 or 30 minutes for Q&A. That would probably be in the ballpark. I don't think you'd want three speakers from the county if you're also going to try and have the cities. And
right, them. Right.
That's overkill on our side. I think it's good to engage the cities also.
Well, let's reach out to those other cities as soon as possible and see, gauge their interest, and then we can adjust accordingly.
Right, you direct me, I'll do that, and then we'll finalize this together. We won't come back. We'll just wrap it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we have similar questions with the intangible cultural resources presentation. We are deciding on a presentation for this, since we seem to be the only folks out there looking at this. And probably your PowerPoint would be a good starting point.
By then?
Yeah.
Did you want to maybe bring the tribe cultural resource director? Would he be interested? Because that's not that they're the only person communicating on, but that's...
Yeah. Nathan? Feel like you're in school. So the National Alliance of
Preservation Commissions.
Preservation Commissions has their big meeting in 2020 in Tacoma. It's the first time that it's been held on the West Coast, and so we've had splinter meetings in Tacoma, you know, Main Street things. So it's a good opportunity for us West Coast Historic Preservation Commissions to get to this meeting where it's national. And we have three proposals, and one of them is the Intangible Cultural Heritage proposal, since we seem to be the only commission in the United States looking at this.
That's unfortunate. Not unfortunate on your part, but
yes.
Not other concerns.
Yeah, so that's why we're sort of casting about for any kind of something to grab onto. And do you think the tribe perhaps be interested in co-presenting? Or as we look for stakeholders to join us in this endeavor, might be good to have
members of said communities.
I think it would be great if there's participation from the new formulation here with the county and the city of Vancouver, and if the tribe could participate as well. I think that that would provide a model for an integrated approach that other communities that are trying to do this maybe in an isolated way would realize that a partnership is more beneficial than going it alone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I do think that it would be worthwhile to reach out to Chinook.
Sure.
As well. I have not heard back. I've been trying. Okay, well, if everyone's, you know, it'd be great to have Cowlitz and Chinook up there together.
Yes.
That would be cool. So, okay, well, let's look into that. And so we've settled the presentation.
Yeah. And it was with one of the HPC members and then two of the tribes.
Mm-hmm.
You?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how far we've come in this year.
Yeah. And when is the...
July.
It's July, so it'll be right at the end of my term.
Yeah. And we'll send you information about it. Cause okay. It's a five-day conference, which you can come to the whole thing if you register, or just come mm-hmm. as a resource for that. It's going to be you. I'll send it through Alex.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sharon, would you still like comments on this, though?
Yes, I do. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Do we want to consider that as a panel? I mean, if we're actually able to get that level of participation
yeah.
from other stakeholders, then I think we might find that there is enough content there for a panel.
So maybe it is a panel with Alex, Nathan, and maybe the Chinook rep? Is that kind of where we're leaning? Okay.
Yeah. I'll switch from email to telephone to try to get a hold of Tony.
All right. So I'll work with Alex to wrap that up.
Okay.
Thank you. And then other comments you can send. Okay, next.
The next one is commissions and building codes, advisory versus what's the...
Opening it, and I think it's bringing up the intangible.
Is it?
I mean, make sure it's not user error.
No.
Oh, there we go. User error. So yeah, it's basically a comparison of what it looks like to have a deliberative body like us enforce preservation requirements versus a building department, a magisterial body, and we have a couple of case studies since we are advisory on all of those decisions, but we're also regulatory on other decisions that makes us kind of an ideal case study and how those two ways of enforcing preservation requirements can end up in different results.
And your case study would be?
I think primarily Providence Academy, but we've got a couple of other ones as well that we can look at. You know, pretty much we can look through the last couple of years that we have familiarity with mm-hmm. as the commissioners and look at any of the, I guess, the larger projects from any of the Vancouver City Heritage Overlay District. So we've had a few of them come through. Mm-hmm.
I thought it sounded really interesting, personally, when I read through your proposal.
And you're envisioning a presentation?
Yeah, I think that's just a presentation. I'm on the NAPC listserv. And these are the sorts of questions that they love to talk about. Is, you know, enforcement and ordinances. So I think that they'll be pretty open to a topic like this.
Sean, do you see the presentation as mostly informational and reviewing case studies and giving examples of what can go in opposite directions if you have that point of view? Or are you looking at, you know, here's what has happened, can happen, and then here are ways that we've seen that these opposing ways or, you know, ministerial ways or judicial ways.
I think in this case, laying out kind of the the structure for us with between the our Clark County Heritage Register and the Heritage Overlay Districts, and just laying out that structure, because that in itself is a little bit unique, and that kind of creates the basis for it. And then, you know, go through the actual requirements and, you know, use our own public record for, you know, this is what the commission, you know, this is the feedback, the advisory that the commission gave, and here's the decision that was made. Yeah. And just show that as, you know, kind of try to really lay it out just as it was.
Does it have a recommendation component to it, or
I think it's
more
think
of a
more,
present, just a
yeah, I think more
present.
Illustrative that, you know, that because we are different than a building department, how the enforcement can end up looking different.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a pretty complex, you know, cause and effect thing because of, you know, how, as you said, how our overlays are set up,
mm-hmm.
what the steps are that a development might go through, and when the first touch, second touch, touches, and when they are reviewed, and what level of responsibility we have, and on and on and on. So that's a tough one to do a succinct, clear.
It'll be a little bit of a challenge up front, I think, on the conciseness, setting the stage. Luckily, our audience is mostly Preservation Commission members,
yeah.
So their baseline knowledge is pretty high, or, you know, staff supporting commissions. So I think that helps. Yes, I'm a little less intimidated by it because I train code officials, so I've had to present on, you know, complex regulatory stuff, and it can usually be done pretty concisely if you can be clear from the beginning. But, you know, I think that we have the material, you know, we have the staff report, we have our own deliberations, and I think it's really interesting to show those next to each other. And, you know, I think it will be important, though, that since we are the one, if, you know, if we're accepted, we're the ones presenting, not to be making value judgments on it, you know, to really just, you know, show that this is how they looked at it from their perspective, because we've got it in the staff report, what that perspective was, and then what the comments of the commission were, which weren't uniform either. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think even that is illustrative.
Yeah. Sounds interesting. I'm glad I don't have to put it together.
We'll submit all three. I mean, we'll finalize the two.
What do you expect to happen? Do you expect all three to be selected, or probably not? Or you have no idea.
Depends on what they get and what.
Do they ever see similar proposals and say, why don't you guys work together and create one?
Sure.
Especially if they have sessions, you know.
So like another city could have a similar proposal, or another state, somewhere in another state, anybody?
I'm sure they could.
Interesting.
All right. So moving right along, the demolition study final report, next steps. So I think that we want to, okay, so the demolition, the final report was submitted last week, correct? I started going through it and editing it and realized, well, if this is the final, what's the point of editing? I did have some questions, which perhaps I maybe should have brought up during the initial one. Maybe the initial draft didn't have some of these, but anyway. I think really what we're charged with at this point is looking at the three recommendations, these flow charts at the end, the recommended next steps. I mean, there are a whole set of parameters that are suggested in the report, such as age, location, the allocation of responsibilities, that kind of thing. Do we want to get into those weeds? I mean, this is probably the time to do it.
We talked about maybe just which option would you want staff to pursue, option one, two, or three, or if you do option one and then a couple years later add two, three, or go
right. Okay, so we could start with looking at the three flow chart options,
yeah.
And then once we decide upon one of those, going into the specifications of age,
but you also don't need to go into the weeds because you can direct staff, and then we'll be presenting things to you as we, right? We would.
How it would fit within the regulatory context of the county.
Yeah.
I think right now it's more like let's get whatever the high level.
Yeah.
What you all want us to move forward to the county.
Right.
Which one of these or some combination of one of them or.
Yeah, and for right now, we're only thinking about this in the context of what we would be recommending to Clark County, not the city of Vancouver, not the other cities, the other jurisdictions. We're just starting with Clark County at this point. So,
Alex,
yes.
We had a subcommittee, I guess, for demolition.
Yes.
Which hasn't met. Why wouldn't you refer this to the subcommittee to spend a little more time thinking through? Would that make any sense?
Good.
That's what I had assumed, and I, when I came here, I said, well, this is obviously fodder for our subcommittee to look at.
Yeah.
It's three pretty different proposals there, A, B, and C, and it might have value. I mean, I can see the value of the subcommittee doing it, but I think, like, the full board looking at all three of those proposals and debating them, because they're all very different, you know, just from just taking information to going up to 40 days. So I kind of think it might have maybe more value having all heads at the table debating back and forth about those possibly.
Well, why wouldn't you let the subcommittee come back and report to the full commission and then at least have a little more? I mean, I don't care. We could do it either way. It'll take a long time to debate it among the whole commission, but it could be done that way. I mean, I agree with you that everybody on the commission ought to be comfortable with whatever comes out of this. I didn't see these as either or. I saw these as three possible outcomes depending on how one determines the importance, the significance of the particular item being demolished.
That's how a coworker of mine read them. You would start at one, and if it was significant enough, you'd go to two, and if it was, you know, determined significant, it would go to three.
I didn't see it as either or.
But I think it's presented as one, two, or three.
Yeah, I read it as one, two, or three. The first steps are the same.
The first steps are the same, and then you know each one gets progressively more towards the preservation end of that spectrum of that documentation versus preservation spectrum. So I saw it as, and you know the problem I have with it, and I mentioned this in an email to staff was, well, I'd hate to come in and recommend number one, and then have the jurisdiction go, well, we want to start with number two, and then we're, you know, the commission that's supposed to be promoting historic preservation ended up sort of shortchanging ourselves by deciding on the first level. But at the same time, we want to keep it realistic, and also with the idea that it may not be a permanent situation. We could start with one, with the recommendation that in 2 years' time it's revisited with an eye towards perhaps moving on towards number two and getting a little more preservation-oriented instead of just strict documentation. So maybe some of these questions are perhaps better discussed by the subcommittee.
I would actually recommend to you, though, that we don't look at these as fixed proposals, that we tweak them, because at least for me, when I was reading through them, I had comments on each one. I have my preference. I already know which one I would vote for, but I want to tweak that one too. So I would hope that, you know, there would still be that room for discussion for all of us to kind of put our two cents in for how we would, you know, incorporate them.
I would agree with both of you. I felt the same way. I looked at all three of them and thought, you know, there's one, I thought that there was a step that was missing as a possible step in at least two of them. And so maybe if the subcommittee takes these as kind of the starting point and then comes back with a recommendation that is, you know, a variance on one of these based on the work that we've already done, a deeper reading of the report, and makes that recommendation to the commission. But, you know, everyone's seen all this, so everyone will have the context to say, well, no, actually, I think we should go further, or I think that's too far. You know, here's a little detail that I think should be injected, but we can at least give that discussion a big jumpstart in the subcommittee.
So my thinking, I do a lot of regulatory work and have to respond to a lot of regulatory work. Now, I used to write them when I was a Fed. Now I have to live with them. We always talk about a graded approach that you have to – I can't believe that every building that's going to be demolished is of equal potential architectural or historical significance. They're all going to be different. And some of these will warrant a very thorough documentation, even if you allow demolition, for future architects and architectural historians to see what was done on that property. When I was with the Postal Service, this came up all the time, that we, as a minimum, would do detailed architectural drawings for people. We usually tried to preserve the buildings altogether, but sometimes you just couldn't. And it seemed, that's why I think that there has to be a range of alternatives rather than a single selection. Otherwise, I think we're selling ourselves short on the importance of looking at these properties before they're demolished. Because it is true that once they're gone, they're gone. And you may have a photograph, that may be enough, but someone who's an architect, and I'm not, but someone who's an architect might love to see some kind of as-built drawings of these things, especially, let's say you're trying to do some kind of a restoration nearby, and you want to get some context of what other properties in the area may have looked like. Wouldn't that be valuable to you as an architect? So that's why I think this needs more thought than just make a decision tonight which way.
Well, how about for commissioners who are not on the subcommittee, they can email me their thoughts, suggestions, recommendations, and I will take them so that when we have our subcommittee meeting before our next meeting, we can come back with those integrated and have a little bit more of a clearer idea of direction we want to go. Does that sound okay?
Then you can represent some of the thoughts that won't be in the
exactly.
And then when you come together, those will have been part of that discussion.
Everyone feel comfortable with that?
Yep.
Okay. All right.
Before we end, I think, Julie, did you have something that you wanted to add to the agenda?
Yeah, sorry, I'm going through my little checklist here. So I don't really know how to approach this, but it's not that big of a deal. But when I was looking through the letter to the new homeowners of historic buildings or historic properties, I was wondering if we already have something in place or if it would be worthwhile to begin implementing something where people who are already on our registers, that they have some kind of group. I don't know what to call it, like a Facebook page, or I don't know. There's some kind of cohesive group of people that we can refer these individuals to so they can get advice and they can get perspective on what it means to be on the historic register. If they are doing restoration work, they can reach out to the people who have already perhaps done the restoration work, how to approach the commission when they have changes that they want to make. Just basically a resource for people. I think if I were to read that letter, I would, you know, I come from a preservational angle, but let's say I was a neutral person, I didn't necessarily have any kind of preference, it would be appealing to me to reach out to people who have already done it, who can tell me the benefits, because I think there's a lot of misconception of what it means to be on a register and how that limits you as a homeowner, and I think that would really engage those that may be on the fence about whether or not they want to list. So that was just a thought I was having. I'm not sure exactly how to do it, but I think it's easy enough to do. And I was even thinking, could we put names of people that would be willing to talk to new homeowners about what it meant to be on the register?
Good idea.
Sounds good. So I'm not sure. I mean, that's one idea, but I don't know how to implement something like that.
Sharon and I, we can talk.
You just ask staff.
we'll think about that and see how, because I think that's a great idea, and because we definitely have some of our property owners that have done recent stuff, and yeah. I know would be happy to reach out to new owners that are interested in doing that. So, and we've had in the past, we had like I did a presentation in Camas, and I got one of our property owners come and talk about the tax incentives that he got for rehabbing this big building. And exactly. So and it was good for people to hear mm-hmm. from the person that actually went through the process and that it how beneficial it was. So I think it's a great idea.
I have another kind of follow-up question, being new to this community. Do we do historic home tours that where people open up their homes that live in them and they have like house tours? Does that make sense?
The commission may have done it in the past. I have not since I've been a staff, But it's something that I think would be something that's going to come back around. Because, and you guys will hear more about it, but I think I briefly told, we're doing, the county's looking at this public benefit rating system for our resources, natural resources, but also historic sites, and getting, giving property owners tax or property tax breaks if they have these resources on their property. And one of the, for historic sites, we talked about, you know, if you open your house up for a tour or, you know, access, then you could get a, you know, some good point value for that. So that would probably, and if that's how it's organized and that's how it's written, then the Historic Commission would be in the place to put that together and do those tours. I believe in our, especially at least in the special valuation, which is one of the tax incentives that historic property owners can get, there's like a clause that, you know, if you're getting this incentive, then you do, you can't, you need to open your house open if tours are scheduled and things like that. And it's just a good thing to let people learn about that.
Yeah. And the Historic Society does lead neighborhood walks for historic buildings and neighborhoods.
Yeah. And a real brief follow-up on what you just said, Alex, and what your two comments was, I think last weekend was the Arnada Walk. I think it was last weekend because they walked past my house. and you know, we had our new little puppy out in front, and the group of people walked by, and there were two nice folks from the Historical Society, who one of which was talking about the house across the street, which is a beautiful old craftsman, very early craftsman with a wraparound porch. I'd really not paid much attention to that property other than I really liked the house and I liked the neighbors. And while we were standing out there, one of the guides was talking about that house. And I had no idea that the house apparently was the home of a renowned author and translator whose translation of, and I didn't catch all the details, but whose work is still in use and still seen as the, you know, the best work out there of this particular translation. I looked it up, house up before I came. It was built in 1909, which is pretty early for a craftsman. And I didn't realize that our neighborhood had been that well developed that early. But at any rate, there are tours, as Alex said, and yes, there are. I mean, now I'm kind of jazzed to go talk to Todd and Jill and say, you guys, you need to get your house listed. It's a gem. Yeah. So just throwing that out there.
And I think I also
I'll see Todd probably later tonight. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, or at the
at the kickball, which is happening right now.
Sarah Fox, the former HPC commission member, had also brought this up last year. We haven't done anything about it. Was to have like a workshop or something for homeowners on what to do with your windows, and that might be another place to have historic property owners be the resource person. Yeah. So when we do our budget discussions next month or two, think about, do you want to do that workshop?
Yeah.
On how to renovate windows and paint colors and energy efficiency, and then have that resource.
And just to circle back really quick, you know, you said just an idea, but there were two. So I hope you capture that there were because there's kind of the forum for the owners to talk to each other and for new people to ask them questions. Mm-hmm. But then there's also kind of the historic register ambassadors who would just be available for people to ask them questions. So those might be separate things. First one might be like a Facebook group, while the second one might just be, you know, a list of a dozen people who are willing to talk to people.
Sure. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Neither of those are my ideas.
Moving right along, any public comment? Holly?
I'm still Holly Chamberlain, but now I am wearing my Washington Trust for Historic Preservation President hat. Just wanted to remind people that the deadline for applying for heritage grants for cemeteries and heritage barns is coming up on October 23rd. You can find more information at dap.wa.gov or preservewa.org, and just hope you'll help share that information with all of your networks. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. Any other business? Anybody?
Just to, I promised, I got a call, received a call from Rob Freed this week. He brought Whipple Creek, mm-hmm. and we've had conversations about the hillborn structures that are out in the park, the mill, and some other things. Well, he I think lives out there, so he must have been on one of the trails and noticed that they're doing some work to it. So he wanted to know if we were involved or had knew what was going on. And I told him that it's my understanding. I reached out to Parks, our Parks Department, but it's mostly a lot of volunteer-driven activity out there because there's just been no resources given to Whipple Creek for all the, they're doing the restoration of the trails, and I guess now the volunteer group that's been doing a lot of work out there wants to work on the structures because they're not safe, and I think they just want to get them more protected. But I think Rob's concern was if they're going to do it correctly. So I told him I would bring it up, just let you all know that he noticed that, and he had a little bit of a concern, and I explained to him that it's not, it's not on the register, not that it shouldn't be or how we go about doing that, but that I would let you know that I talked to him. And
does the county have any properties of its own on the register?
Yeah, the farm.
Okay.
And the courthouse is on the National Register.
Well, I mean the Clark County Heritage Register.
Farm. So just food for thought, maybe it's something we get into in a future meeting about those. That
listing them, or?
Maybe. If that's something the commission is interested in.
Short term, maybe sending somebody out there to take a look.
Yep. It'd be a nice hike. That's all.
All right. I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Ulterior motives.
No injuries tonight, right?
No considered.